This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. Welcome back to our weekly series on inequality in the Baltimore region, The Lines Between Us. I'm Sheila Cast. 2 years ago, we interviewed urban planner Daniel Dioka about a MICA exhibition that looked at what makes people feel welcome or unwelcome in a city neighborhood. It was called Baltimore, Open City.
We define an open city as a place where everyone feels welcome, regardless of race, religion, age, gender, et cetera, et cetera.
Dioka studies policies and physical things right out on the street that work either to open a city or close it.
So what are some examples of things that close the city? They range from big things like exclusionary zoning, but also smaller things. We have a list of 101 ranging from, no loitering signs to blockbusting to classical music is in there, referring to the use of classical music by developers who sometimes have these little hidden speakers in shopping malls, and they do this, of course, to scare skateboarders away.
Next year, Dan and two co-authors are set to publish a book called The Arsenal of Exclusion and Inclusion. The physical and policy barriers they describe that push people of different backgrounds apart, those are literally the lines between us. So we invited Daniel back. He took senior producer Lawrence Lanahan and me to a couple spots near the station to show us a few weapons in the arsenals of exclusion and inclusion. We started out driving down St. Paul Street, then parked across the street from Penn Station.
If you've noticed, between that street, which is Landvale, and Mount Royal, there's not a single crosswalk. In Baltimore, there's this historic east-west divide. And in part, it's really reflected in the infrastructure. Sometimes it's really difficult to move east and west in the city. And here's a really good example. It's 600 yards or at least where there's nowhere to cross the street, right? We're going to have to jaywalk. Let's see how it goes.
Jaywalk fast. So here we are. In front of Penn Station, we just jaywalked across St. Paul to get here. What are we looking for, Dan?
An interesting form of segregation. What we're looking at here on Charles is we're looking at two bus stops, right? So there's one bus stop right here. That's the public bus stop. And so you see the 64 bus and the 3, and I think there's, I don't know how many buses that this bus stop serves. And then you look to your left, and you can see the Johns Hopkins shuttle and the College Town Network shuttle, which stops right there about 100 yards away from the city bus stop. It's not the biggest deal in the world, but in some ways it's just kind of one of these moments where the town and gown student bubble kind of student versus the rest of the city dynamic plays out pretty well, where you typically see a line of mostly white kids who are waiting to pick up the private Johns Hopkins shuttle. So it's not the end of the world, but it's just one of these moments where I think probably we'd be a little bit better off if we had students who were more a part of the city and rode the bus like everybody else. So it's just this kind of moment where you walk out of the station and this kind of dynamic and this segregation is just, it's kind of right there in your face. So
what else should we look at here?
There's a lot to look at here. I mean, this is a really interesting and dynamic space, I think. I mean, it's a place where, obviously, this is a lot of people's first experience of Baltimore. This is a space that's more familiar to people. The city did just put out these umbrellas and tables and chairs, which seems like a great idea. It seems like a step in the right direction to change this from a space that's just about getting from point A to B to a place where you might stop and hang out and talk to someone.
Okay, where are we going next?
There's a great example of a park, a defensible park, where you could do literally nothing, not too far from here. You can't eat, you can't sit, you can't picnic, you can't listen to music, you can't do anything. So I thought that would be a funny place to check out.
Can we walk there?
Yeah, we can walk there. By the way, here's a situation that's very unlike the one we just saw, because here's a situation where the circulator, the public buses, the Hopkins shuttle, all stop in the same place.
This is on St. Paul.
Yeah, and this is on St. Paul. So, again, it's not like this is going to change the world necessarily, but still two separate transportation systems, the private shuttle, the public bus, but at least they are in the same bus stop.
Okay, where do you want to jaywalk?
Oh, man.
So this is a good time.
Go.
St. Paul.
Yep. In a hurry.
Is this the park?
This is it. So, they actually took the sign down.
Good thing you have a picture of it on your iPhone.
Another one. And also, yeah, I do have a picture of it. No loitering, no bicycling, no ball playing, no dogs, no alcoholic beverages, no picnicking, no trash dropping, no skateboarding. All violators will be prosecuted. This is what happens when you go away for a year and a half. This is progress. This is really great.
Do you think they took it down to be more inclusive?
Let's hope so. I mean, let's hope they read my blog post about it and said, "Oh man, that guy's right. That park is really the pits. We need to make it more fun." I mean, something I was going to say is that it's, you know, this is something you see in a lot of parks, like no loitering signs. And it's not just this one. I mean, and it's not just parks, right? You see that in a lot of places. But what is loitering? I mean, that's a kind of funny thing. It's this kind of ubiquitous sign. But it, you know, if you look at the way that cities try to even define what loitering is and how you can be arrested for it, it's always these like super vague things like, you know, sit, stand, loaf, lounge, wander, or stroll in a nameless manner, you know, to pause or remain in the area with no obvious reason, or, you know, appear at a place under circumstances that warrant alarm. It's always these things that you could see in the legislation, in the ordinances, people struggling to say, like, what is it that somebody's doing wrong? So it's this really funny thing, even though the loitering signs are everywhere.
If there's a no loitering sign in a park, doesn't that mean it's not a park? Because loitering is kind of what people do in parks.
Like what we're doing right now, right?
Well, we're working. I don't know how Dan explains what he's doing, but we're on the clock.
This is clearly not loitering. But yeah, I would say if you can't loiter in a park, it's not a park. I would say that would be maybe the number one basic function of a park, is to encourage loitering. So if you can't loiter in the park, it's not a park.
And where does inequality play into this? Do you think loitering is enforced equally across the board?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably all kinds of reasons. I mean, like I said, it's always case specific. But the thing is, once something like that gets in there, once a precedent is set for a no loitering ordinance and a no loitering signs, people sort of use it for all kinds of, you know, nefarious purposes. So people want to not have kids hanging out on the corner. People want to not have people demonstrating or whatever they're doing. I mean, cities are supposed to bring people together, right? Cities are places where you're supposed to be able to hang out, bump into people, talk to people. Yeah, so we're on Green Mountain now and we're heading north. So we just passed 33rd. And we talked before about the kind of difficulty you have sometimes traveling east and west in Baltimore. So there's a kind of east-west divide in Baltimore that really plays out across the infrastructure. And here's a really good example. So on the right side of Greenmount, the kind of Waverly side, you've got a neighborhood that's, you know, roughly 85% African American, you know, 15% bachelor degree, 40,000 median income roughly. On the west side, which is the Oakenshaw and eventually the Guilford side, you've got a much different demographic. You've got, first of all, it's like 96% white or something like that, 75,000 median income, huge majority of people here have a bachelor's degree. So it's one of these moments that you find a lot in Baltimore where you have this really stark divide that's, you know, really close proximity, but a big difference demographically. What's really interesting about this particular divide and this particular wall is it's very evident physically. So as we drive up Green Mountain, we go north, I just want to point out a couple kind of physical things that are kind of symbolic representations of this demographic divide. So the net effect is basically between 33rd and Cold Spring on Green Mountain, there's, I think, maybe two crosswalks and only one place where you can make a left and actually go into Oakenshaw.
There's a one-way, the wrong way.
So there's a one-way, the wrong way. So when I say there's a bunch of different tactics, that's one way. So here's another tactic, which are these bollards. There's no way to make a left into there. The street is discontinuous. It dead ends into these bollards.
Yeah, if you knock those bollards down, you could take a left.
You'd have to knock the bollards down, and you'd also have to take away the curb. So you also see that there's no crosswalks going between left and right. And so here's another example, do not enter signs, right? So that's two tactics. We've got the bollards and now we've got the big do not enter signs. So no way to make that left. Again, in most cases, you have no problem being able to make the right-hand turn. So now we're crossing.
That's 39th Street.
39th, you can make a left there. That's one of the few instances. Again, so Wine Oak, we can make a right into there, no problem. Still no way to go left and penetrate into Oakenshaw, or now I guess we're at Guilford. So now we've got hedges and fences. And so here again, we're coming up again on another one-way street. So that's a third tactic to add here. There's no way to make a left into here at Underwood, right? Even though you can make a left out of Underwood. And so now we're north of Underwood. The neighborhood of Guilford is separated by this retail buffer. And there's a stone wall and gates that make it look like a kind of gated community. And once again, do not enter one-way signs. So we've traveled quite a long distance now. And there's another one-way street. We still haven't really found a good way to get left. So again, this isn't going to solve the problems of Baltimore by making the street continuous and making it easier for people to get from Waverly to Guilford, let's say, or Oakenshaw. But again, it's one of these moments where in the city, some demographic divide is made very spatially evident.
Urban planner Daniel Dioka. He's a principal at Interborough Partners, an office of architects, urban designers, and planners in Brooklyn, New York. He's also an assistant professor of urban and architecture history and theory at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and design critic in urban planning and design at the Harvard Design School. Dan's book, Arsenals of Exclusion and Inclusion, will be published by ACTAR next year. His co-authors are Tobias Armbrust and Georgine Theodore. At our website, linesbetweenus.org, we'll have a link to their blog and to a fantastic segment with Dan from the design radio program 99% Invisible. On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast. Up next on The Lines Between Us, talking across the lines in Northwest Baltimore. Stay with us on WYPR.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Morning's The Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
Morning, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. For the past few weeks, the verdict in the George Zimmerman trial has been resonating in communities throughout the Baltimore region and the nation. That includes Northwest Baltimore, where residents found parallels with a violent incident that happened there in 2010. It involved the assault of 15-year-old Corey Ousby, who's African American. Ousby was confronted by Elihu Wertesheim, an Orthodox Jew who was at the time a member of a neighborhood watch group called Shamrin. Wertesheim, who is white, was found guilty of assault and false imprisonment. Wertesheim's brother, Avi, was also charged with assault but was cleared of all charges. The victim, Corey Ousby, refused to testify at the trial. This morning, as we continue our series, The Lines Between Us, we talk with two residents of Northwest Baltimore, Phyllis Ajayi, an African-American woman, and Nathan Wilner, a white Orthodox Jewish man, co-chair the Community Conversations Leadership Team. The group meets monthly to talk about relations between the respective communities in their neighborhood, and they join me in the studio. Welcome and good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Phyllis, Northwest Baltimore is a huge geographic area. Tell us about the neighborhood that we're talking about with your group, the Community Conversations Leadership Team, and where is it?
We are approximately five neighborhoods. We consist of Falstaff, Cross Country, Glen, Cheswold, and Mount Washington. Mm-hmm.
And that's five out of like 38 neighborhoods that comprise what the police district refers
right.
to as
right.
as Northwest. How long have you lived in the neighborhood?
My entire life.
Uh-huh. And Nathan, what was the impetus for this group, the Community Conversations Leadership
well,
getting together?
As you mentioned in your opening piece, as a result of that incident that occurred about 2 years ago, a focus group was put together, a study with two facilitators where they brought together various segments of the community to do a background on people's opinions on race and their relationships between within their own community and without the community.
And what's your personal history in the neighborhood? How long have you lived there?
Lived in Baltimore since law school. Went to Narrazor Rabbinical College, then went to University of Maryland Law School and been here ever since. So over 20 years, uh-huh. 25 years.
So you both have long, long ties to the community. Phyllis, what was the initial reaction to, take us back to 2010 when this incident happened. What was the tenor of the community at that point?
The people who actually lived in the community, there wasn't an uproar. It wasn't viewed the way it was viewed in the media. So it really didn't cause too much confusion within the community. The confusion came from media coverage.
And why do you think that is? I mean, in other words, did people, when you say there wasn't too much of a reaction, did people just say, well, that kind of stuff happens all the time, or...
What? No, I mean, I think it was disturbing, you know, that something like that would happen. But I don't think it was labeled as a true racial incident. It just was an incident, you know, that happened.
Irrespective of how the media was reporting this, what was your personal reaction when you heard about this case with the Wertesheim brothers and Corey Ausby?
Well, the only way I knew was from the media. You know, so that was another indicator that it wasn't so terrible in the neighborhood, because if there was an uproar in the neighborhood, then I should have heard from my neighbor or something. So I heard about it. Now, I mean, obviously, as an African-American parent, you know, it is concerning because my children do walk, you know, the neighborhood. And I wouldn't want to think that my children would be walking and be in danger. But, you know, again, I heard it from the media. I didn't hear it from, you know, outside, or even, you know, my kids come home and tell me things when they hear it. So they didn't even hear anything about it.
Mm-hmm. And Nathan, how about you? Did you encounter this incident the same way?
Well, I heard about the incident, but again, as far as the kind of the racial component that we're discussing today, that only came much later. And that was as a result of, again, voices from outside the community coming in and kind of taking a personal stake in a situation and an incident that they really had no understanding of or really knew all the participants in the situation. There was no indication from the voices I heard within the community that this was a racially motivated incident, not one.
And Phyllis, that's your take too.
Yeah. Not from within the community.
Yeah. Yeah, it's because it just seems so at odds. Do you understand that it's mm-hmm. kind of shocking to me, because it seems so at odds with what we understand the relationship of the black community to the police and the black community to the white communities in these places where things are stratified.
To that point, I would say. Because, I mean, we're speaking specifically about our Northwest Baltimore
right.
neighborhood. But again, you know, on a personal note, as an African American, have I ever experienced any sort of profiling or prejudice? Yes. But it hasn't been at home.
And you feel like that whatever kinds of misunderstandings may have been in place in 2010, they have in fact now been solved?
I wouldn't say solved, but we have resources, we have mechanisms that are in place that, okay, if this comes up, this is what we're going to do, mm-hmm. or this is, you know, where we're going to go with this. So, I mean, a lot of that came from just not being prepared. You know, it just all came down at one time and we didn't know what to do. So, I mean, no, the world is not, you know, all peaches and cream.
And know? Nathan, how about you? What have you learned personally through the experience of these conversations?
I've learned that the similarities among the neighbors are a lot more prominent than the differences. I've also learned that don't assume someone understands why you do what you do. You need to open the lines of communication. And what we've found is once the conversation starts and explanations are made, it's a sense of community really is there, and you know, you see in your neighbor's eyes and in their body language that they're accepting and understanding. It's just a matter of making the effort and the time to have the conversation.
Well, Phyllis Ajayi, Nathan Wilner, I really appreciate both of you coming by. Thank you so much for your time, and good luck with your continuing work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Phyllis Ajayi and Nathan Wilner co-chair the Community Conversations Leadership Team in Northwest Baltimore. We've got a link to more information about their organization at our website, linesbetweenus.org. We also want to hear your thoughts. What's your take on the relationship between people of different races in Northwest Baltimore and in your neighborhood? Let us know at 410-881-3162. Again, that's 410-881-3162. On 88.1, you're listening to The Lines Between Us, our year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus, or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.